Let me introduce Cheryl, and then we will frame a little bit about what we're going to talk about and why we are excited to talk about it. So Cheryl and her husband are good friends of ours from St. Philip's. My wife Jane is right back here, and we are so delighted that Cheryl and her husband are now part of our St. Philip's orbit, which is a great thing. Cheryl will not tell this about herself, but she is brilliant. She went to Georgia Tech, graduated in mechanical engineering from Georgia Tech, which is no small accomplishment. And then she went on to get a graduate degree in actuarial science, which is also no small accomplishment. But you could say from that that she is pretty oriented toward things that are not what you might think of as reading novels. So lots of data, lots of numbers, all of those things. But Cheryl recently took on this project where she felt like she had never, despite her brilliance and her great education, she had never been exposed to the great classical works of literature, whether that be philosophy or religion or fiction. And so she took on this project of reading her way through this incredible list of great books, and she started a podcast focusing on that that's called Crack the Book, which has attracted a lot of followers. I recommend it. It's very well done. But she has become a great apologist for reading. And I wanted to just sort of frame what we're going to be talking about. Part of the reason we're talking about that here is that the scriptures enjoin us to love God with our mind. That's part of the great commandment. Love God with your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Love your neighbor as yourself, which is even on the wall next to the altar at St. Philip's. So it might be pretty important. We also, a lot of us, if we've grown up in the church, we know the idea of your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit. We know about trying to be healthy, stay in shape, all those kinds of things. But we don't usually think about what does it mean to love God with our mind. We also don't really think about what does it mean, all those scriptures that tell us to read scriptures and to share them with our children, and all of that sort of way of being that involves loving God with the gifts that we've been given in terms of our intellect. And reading is one of the prime ways of doing that. But unfortunately, we are, or y'all are, in the generation that is perhaps most famous for not reading. Sorry. No judgment. It's not your fault. It is all the fault of this. So the iPhone, according to lots of studies, has been responsible for the greatest shift in attention span since they've started keeping records of these things. And the attention span shrinks directly in proportion to how much time you spend on screens. And this has actually become a really interesting problem. One of the places that this has become a big problem, believe it or not, is with Broadway shows. Because it used to be, you know, if you're paying $150 for a ticket to go watch a Broadway show, you're going to actually watch the show. But what they're finding is people cannot stay off their phone in these shows. And so they've had to, like, enact pretty strict measures to get people not to do that, because we are so used to this, our attention wanders, we have to have our phone. But the unfortunate thing that they've also discovered is that all this screen time is literally rewiring our brains, and that is the reason our attention spans are getting shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter. And that is really bad for us on a lot of levels. One of the things that's directly connected to short attention span is anxiety. The shorter your attention span, the higher and more prone to anxiety you're going to be. Another thing that is related to short attention span is inability to engage in meaningful relationships, inability to experience empathy, and also being narcissistic. So all of those are perhaps not great things. So we want to talk a little bit about why both of us are passionate about reading. And one of the great things about reading, and we'll come to some of these stats in a little while, is there's been a raft of studies, particularly since COVID, about how good reading is for you. And in a lot of ways, it's like if you think about the fact that so many people, when they make New Year's resolutions, go join a gym to try to get in better shape physically, or are doing a running program or something like that. Reading is actually like going to the gym for your brain. And these studies have shown that reading counteracts all of the stuff that technology is doing to your brain, and it can actually rewire your brain back in a good way. So we're going to talk a little bit more about that. So given that framework, hi.
Hi.
So I would love to just hear a little bit about your journey of reading and how you came to love reading and how you came to this amazing project that you've been in the middle of.
Okay, well, okay, so I've always been a reader. My grandmother stitched needle-pointed, who was my needle-pointer in here? My grandmother needle-pointed a stocking for me when I was a child. It had a bookworm on it. So I was a reader from a long time back. But as I got through school, I was kind of naturally drawn to math and science. My English teachers, were not very good. I wasn't very engaged by a lot of the English in high school. And got to college, was able to AP out of my English classes, and so I managed to get a bachelor's degree and a master's degree with never taking an English class.
Wow.
Kept reading a little, but I just wasn't engaged by a lot of, and I actually also felt intimidated at some point by the classics, right? Those books you needed a guide for. The ones that I had encountered, I was bored by or confused by because, and or I had teachers who would say, well, you can't read that book without help. Not to me, but to the class. Like, that one's really hard. That's a really bad thing for a teacher to tell you, I think. But that was my experience with school. I kept reading some as I when I was out. It was more like a respite from my numbers. And then, and as I got older, I started realizing that I was missing something big. Because I would hear people talk about some of these books that I'd never read, like The Odyssey. I'd never read The Odyssey. I had never read Dante. I had never read a lot of these books. But I never quite knew where to start. Because I would pick up a book, and it was like, I had come, have you ever come in on a movie like a half hour late? And you're like, wait a minute, what? Something was just happening here, but I don't quite know. Well, that's often how I felt when I was reading some of these books, because it was like they all knew this language that I didn't know. And it was something that happened before. And so, I'm pretty old now, and I had, I would read some books. I had gotten interested in Russian history. I read some Russian books, not in Russian, just in English. And, but I came across a reading list about a year and a half ago, it's more like 2.5 years ago now. And it seemed to answer these questions I had of like, where did things come from? Because it was in a chronological order. It was a big challenge, but I was, at that point, I'm much older than y'all. I see one of my girls back there. But so my kids were at a point where they didn't need me. I had my attention, and I decided to start reading this list. It started with Plato. And it ended with David Foster Wallace and the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was a 52-week project that I just finished. So I had never read Plato when I started. I had never read The Odyssey. I had read Dante. But I hadn't read Lamort d'Arthur, you know, the Arthurian legend. I had not read any Shakespeare since high school. And I had only read Romeo and Juliet and Julius Caesar. And that was it. So in the last year, my life really transformed me, and so I've become quite an advocate for reading as a way to know the world better and to know yourself better. And there are so many things that the Lord lays out for you that are unexpected from it.
Yes. Well, that is such a beautiful story, and I love the fact that instead of just feeling bad about not ever having read these things and getting down on yourself, that you decided to do something about it and you figured out a method to make it happen. And also that you're sharing it with other people, because the podcast, I think one of the things you do in that podcast that I love is you pretty regularly say, you can do this. You can do this. It's not that hard. You know, and
sometimes it is hard, but that's okay.
Right. And it is. And you put it in bite-sized chunks. Yeah. And I think that makes it easier. But I think part of what is so stunning about this drop-off in reading is that there used to be sort of a core body of knowledge mm-hmm. that if you were a reasonably educated person living in the Western world that you would know. And so pretty much everybody knew something about Plato, Socrates, and Aristotle. You might not have deep knowledge, but you knew something. And now that's just gone.
I think that's been gone for a long time.
It has been.
Because I'm not going to tell you how old I am, but I'm
not as old as I am.
I'm plenty old, and it was already
gone. It was already gone then.
From school.
Yeah. It was going when I was in school, which was a long time ago. But, you know, part of the reason that these books are important, and I love this example, y'all know who the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. was, right? Founder and pioneer of civil rights, amazing theologian on a lot of levels. But he was asked one time by an interviewer, if you were, it's that question you always get asked, if you were stuck on a desert island and you could only have one book, and we're not going to count the Bible, what book would you want with you? And his answer was Plato's Republic. And that is not what most people would think his answer would be, but it just shows you how formative some of these books are. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that is so important about this is as we look at what happens to a culture when people stop reading is this growth in anxiety, growth in narcissism, all these things. And I just want to read off a couple of these statistics that are from some of these studies. All of these are within the past mm-hmm. 5 years or so. So there was a study in England that had a pretty big sample size that showed that if you sat down and read for 6 minutes, it's not very long, 6 minutes, but sat down, read, no screen, no anything on, it slows your heart rate, it eases muscle tension, and cuts perceptions of stress by 68%. More than listening to music, more than going on a walk, more than having a nice cup of tea, all of those things. Another showed that people who read every week in a disciplined way had much lower rates of depression and anxiety. One of the ones that I thought was really fascinating, this was a Yale study that went over 12 years, it was the longest of these studies, that people who read every week 3.5 hours or more, that's not a lot for a whole week, 3.5 hours.
A half hour a day.
Yeah, half hour a day, had a 20% lower risk of dying over the next decade than the control group who didn't. That's pretty astounding. If y'all don't have to worry about this yet, but people my age do, regular reading slows cognitive decline in older adults by 32%. And the one that I thought was most fascinating is that reading fiction activates a part of the brain that's called the sensory cortex, and that is the part that processes smells, sounds, textures, motion. And when you read fiction and you are deeply, or history, and you're deeply engaged, your brain processes those things as if they were real and that you were actually there. This is part of the reason that people love The Lord of the Rings, because when you get into that, you feel like you are there, that you are walking with them in that story. One of the interesting things in the study is that scrolling, if you're reading a book and scrolling on your phone to do it, it does not produce this effect. This only works when you're actually holding a physical book. Kindle doesn't work for it either. And then another study showed that 20 minutes of daily reading produces measurable long-term beneficial effects on stress, memory, emotional intelligence, and lifespan. So those are pretty astounding statistics. If it were some like drug that did that, that would be selling faster than GLP-1 is. But the fact of the matter is, it's like reading, people are like, eh. But it's really important, and if you engage it, it can literally change your life. So I would love to hear a little bit about what your favorite book or two might be.
From the last year or overall?
However you would like.
Okay, so overall.
Yeah.
And this is many years, several years ago. I love A Gentleman in Moscow. And that is by Amor Towles. It's his second book that he wrote. He's a masterful storyteller. But like this story, I have a girlfriend and we both love this book so much. And we regularly talk about how much we would love to have dinner with the Count. but it was a story set in, I don't know if you know this story, a man is sentenced to house arrest in post-revolution Russia. And he's sentenced to house arrest in the Metropole Hotel, which is at the time the nicest hotel in Moscow. He's a count, and he should have been executed. But because they thought he wrote a revolutionary poem that inspired all these revolutionaries, they couldn't put him to death, but they could sentence him to house arrest. And it's the story of his life and the story of the life that he makes within the walls of this hotel. And it just blows your mind how, but he thought his life was over and it was only getting started. And he ends up leading the most beautiful life. And it's a wonderfully told story. But it just kind of led me down a lot of different, I ended up reading, I couldn't understand how a society could do something so cruel and yet have such beauty. And I didn't understand what happened. So I ended up reading things like War and Peace. And I read Solzhenitsyn, who wrote The Gulag Archipelago about being in prison in this society. And I read a lot of Russian history. So yeah, you outed me already as a nerd. And so, but that book led me to a lot of other things. And that's part of what I feel so affectionate about it towards. But there were so many characters in that book that I absolutely fell in love with. And so that's one.
Yeah. Well, and that's one of mine too. So well done.
Yeah.
So I think one of the things that you will find is that if you start reading, and we talked about this when Rachel was here and we were talking about Elizabeth Googe, that when you can enter into the world of some of these characters, it will enrich your life in a way that you can't even imagine before you read the book. And they become kind of a part of who you are. And that is something that is really beautiful. But one of the things I wanted to talk about a little bit is how do you, if you're not in the habit of reading, how do you start? And one of the things that we already mentioned out of this study is that physical books are actually important. I would say it's better to read on Kindle than not to read at all, but a physical book is a different kind of experience. And that doesn't have to be expensive. You can get books at the library. There's also a website that I love that's called Thrift Books, where you can find used books for like super cheap. And one of the things I love about a used book is very often they're inscribed, and you can just sort of imagine some other person in some other place having read this, and there's kind of a kinship that comes from that. So I think having a physical book is important. Having a plan for how you're going to read and setting aside some time to make that happen. It's sort of like, think about it like going to the gym. If you're going to the gym, you have to decide when you're going to go. You have to have sort of a schedule and maybe figure out during the week when you're going to go and what you're going to do. So having a schedule and having the commitment to do it, having accountability about it. And one of the great things about reading is that is a great thing to do with another person. To say, let's try this, and maybe both read the same book and then talk about it. That can be something that is beautiful. And you can also sometimes read with another person where you're reading a book out loud. That can be great.
Shakespeare is great for that.
Yeah, Shakespeare is great for that. C.S. Lewis is great for that as well. But another thing, and this is something that I think a lot of people don't think about, is the place where you're going to read. I think if you have a chair that you really like that's comfortable, that has a good lamp by it, and I like sometimes to listen to music that's usually classical or soft music when I'm reading, or maybe the 10-hour loop of the Shire theme. But if you have a place like that, that is comfortable, where you're not going to be disturbed, that's beautiful, and where maybe you have a cup of tea or a glass of wine or something like that, and maybe even light a candle and make it sort of a special time in terms of the ambiance, you are much more likely to keep doing that than if you're just trying to find 15 minutes here and there. But I would love to hear some of your hints about how do you make that happen.
So a lot of what you're talking about are things that I thought about for this project. So the first thing that, I mean, I just want to jump up and down about is actual books. I made it a priority. I was curious when I started this year-long project. What if I only read hard books? Because I have a Kindle, and I always took it on vacation with me. I bought a Kindle after I took Brothers Karamazov. I took Brothers Karamazov, which is like this
it's
thick.
It's like this big.
I took it to Europe and back with me twice. So I carried a brick with me in the backpack twice. And I was like, oh, I can't do that anymore. So I got a Kindle. But I thought for this project that I was doing, I'm going to buy or go to the library. But I ended up buying. I'm going to buy physical books in person. I wanted to go to a bookstore if I could and purchase them off the shelf.
Yes, that's really
it was
great.
It's a really fun experience. If you do it more than a couple times, you get picky about what your book looks like. You start looking for a book that has, like, and it's kind of fun to be a little bit nerdy about, like, oh, I want the hardbound because it's going to look good when I finish it. It's going to look so pretty on my bookshelf. and so that is one thing. And I will tell you that I believe, for me, that physical books helped increase my retention.
And the studies will back you up on that.
I don't know if you've ever, like, if you've read physical books, I don't know what you guys had, but even for textbooks for me, I remember what the book felt like and where on a page I was reading something. So I can roughly go back and find it because I know, mm-hmm. like, how far back it was and where on a page it was so I could find it in a way I couldn't do with a Kindle. And so that was a really good experiment for me. And now I have these lovely books on my bookshelf now, too. And so let's see, schedule. I did not have a schedule, and I called myself out on this when I got done with this reading for the year. I didn't give myself a schedule because I was traveling a lot during this year, and I thought, oh, I'm just going to catch as catch can. So my project, I was reading 250 pages a week, and sometimes it was easy. Like, sometimes it was a novel, and that's a piece of cake. And sometimes it's really hard because one week I had Kant and Spinoza and Descartes. And so those are three philosophers from like the 1600s and 1700s. And that was really, really hard. And so I did not have a set schedule of reading. And I came down to the end of my week when I needed to have things read. And I would be like Friday night and I had like 4 hours of reading to do left for the week. That's bad. So this is it's a really good habit. Since my project was over, I've tried to like give myself the space. I do it in the morning. I read for a half hour in the morning now. And it's, you know, that's only been about a month and a half, and that's really been, it's actually kind of a lovely way. I don't get to it every morning. That's okay. But that's kind of when I'm doing it. Let's see, what else? A list. So
yes.
A plan of what you're going to read. So for me on that project, I had 52 weeks. It's on Substack, this list that I found. But for me, I had 52 weeks of reading laid out, and that was really great. I never had to say, okay, what am I going to read next? Because isn't that a problem sometimes? You finish a book, and you really love it, and then it's like all
What's
of a sudden
next?
You get done, and then you've gone a week without even figuring out what you're going to read next because you were so in love with the thing you just finished. That happens to me a lot. I will fall in love with characters. It's really what I do. I fall in love with the people, and I really don't want to leave them. And so unless you've got like kind of a couple books coming up, it's really hard to get started again because you don't want to leave those guys behind. Sounds kind of funny maybe, but that's a really good thing. Maybe one good way to have a plan is to decide, you know, if you're going to read Pride and Prejudice, maybe you read Sense and Sensibility to go along mm-hmm. with it. Or maybe you read something else that was written around the same time, maybe for an American, or maybe you read a later woman author, or you know, something kind of related. But it's just a way to think about, like, it will doing those related books as a plan is a way to kind of make sure you remember those things. And it gives you a way to compare a couple of books. And I think that's a way that is going to help you remember the parts of it that can change you.
Yeah.
Because the things about some of these books, not every book is going to change you. It's not, you don't want every book to change you. That would be bad, because some of those books you don't want. Anyway, but some of them you do. Some of them you want to walk away and go, yeah, okay, I'm a better person for having met the pilgrim. Or I'm a better person for having hung out with the Pride and Prejudice sisters. I can't think of their names right now. But, you know, I'm a better person for having done some of that.
Yeah. Well, and I think one of the things that is so great about knowing what you're going to read next or sort of having a plan is that you can go ahead when you have the opportunity to go to the bookstore or to borrow books from people to have them ready, you know,
yeah.
So that you're never grasping for something and there's nothing there. One of the things that I think is a great thing to get in the habit of doing is ask your friends, what is your favorite book? What is the best thing you've ever read? And keep a running list of that. That is really good. I also think it's great if you've never read the classics to find some kind of classics reading plan. There are a lot of them out there. There's a great sort of introduction book that's called Invitation to the Classics, that if you're not very excited about the classics, if you look at that book, it might help get you there. But I think all of those things can be good. The other thing that can be great, that especially if it is in the morning or in the evening when you're reading, but still daylight, reading outside can be a really good thing to do. Sitting by Colonial Lake or down at the Battery and reading outside can be a really wonderful experience. And I also want to just give a plug for that old-fashioned idea that you might have thought of from your mom of the book club. A book club can actually be a really good thing to do, where you have several people who are reading the same book, and then you get together to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so it's almost time for us to go to questions. Do you have any parting words of advice?
Oof. Just don't let anyone tell you that a book isn't for you, and don't let anyone tell you that a book is too hard. There's no gatekeeping. Anybody who wants to gatekeep a book on you is wrong. They're wrong. So don't feel like any book isn't for you, because you can do it. There's a way in. There's always a way in.
And my parting advice would be check out Cheryl's podcast I think it's very motivational because you're very real in it about sometimes it's a struggle, but most of the time there's a lot of joy that you find in places that you didn't expect it.
Yeah,
so
for sure.
That is really great. So I hope that y'all will think about this and give it a shot and see what change it might bring in your life if you started incorporating some more reading. So why don't we take a minute and go ahead, and if you have some questions, go ahead and send those in, and Alexandra will get us going.
Yes. So after the Bible, what book or books would you recommend everyone should read?
That is such an interesting question. So I will give you one answer, and then I will see what Cheryl has to say about that. One of the things that I think is interesting, wearing sort of the classics hat, is to think about what did people used to read after the Bible as their first choice. So in the colonial period, up until probably the first part of the 19th century, the most commonly read book in the English-speaking world after the Bible was Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan. I think that is a great book to read. In the Middle Ages, it was Boethius's The Consolation of Philosophy.
It's a banger.
It is.
It is really a banger. It's great.
It's one of C.S. Lewis's favorite books. So I think those are good things to think about. I also am a big fan, y'all have heard me talk about this before, it sounds so intimidating, St. Athanasius's Treatise on the Incarnation, that sounds like, but it is so good. I mean, it's so good, and it's not that long, and it's written in a very approachable way, so I think that's really good. I think there's a lot of great theological fiction out there, but I've said enough. Your turn.
The Odyssey. The Odyssey is like the basis of journeys.
Yeah.
It's foundational. It's the story of if you've read it, you know. It opens with a teenage boy who misses his dad. His dad's been gone his whole life, and so he's going to go out and try to find his dad. That's how it starts. And then you cut to the dad trying to get home. It's the story of a journey, and then there's a stalwart and brave, truly courageous wife who's brilliant. And so there's this three characters that are just trying to find their way back to each other. It's foundational. So many stories come out of that one story. And we've got the Bible with its stories of journeys, right? Exodus is a journey story. And then Paul's travels all throughout the Roman world. That's a journey. And what's really interesting is then to compare this journey story that Homer wrote to. So you've got a variety of journey stories, and it's just a really cool way to get another look at humanity.
Mm-hmm. Great question.
Which book of the Bible would you recommend a non-believer to read first?
That's so hard, but such a good question. I would say either the Gospel of John, or if it's somebody with a really short attention span, maybe the Gospel of Mark. I think the Gospel of John is so profoundly beautiful. It is a profoundly excellent work of literature, even just forgetting the theological part of it. But the theology of it is just beautiful, and it makes the presence of Jesus palpable in a way that I think is just remarkable. So I think that is a really good one. The Gospel of Mark is also really good. It's shorter than John, and it's much more action-oriented, much more, it's not as reflective as the Gospel of John.
He says immediately a lot. Immediately.
He does.
Immediately.
Yes. Yeah, it makes it sound like they're all rushing around all the time. But it's good. It's also a very compelling vision of Jesus. And I would also say, just for those of us who are Christians, we live in a culture that has turned Scripture into sound bites, and we've gotten so used to thinking about chapter and verse in Scripture that we forget that the Gospels were written as each of them is a literary work. And it's really an incredible experience to read a Gospel from beginning to end in one sitting. Mm-hmm. And I had not done that until I was in my 40s. So nobody had ever told me I should do that. But I would really commend that. That's a great thing to do.
I want to jump up and down when you, like, that is so important. So this reading project that I did, do you mind if I answer?
No, go ahead.
So this reading project that I did, in 1 week, we read Genesis, Ecclesiastes, the four Gospels, and Romans. Okay, so you're getting it really fast, right? And nobody ever reads it that fast. When I read the four Gospels back to back to back to back, John
jumped off the page.
I had to just stop. John is the most phenomenal work of literature I think you could read. I mean, I still think that I've read so much now, and it holds up. It's a masterwork of literature. It is not just a great gospel. Mm-hmm. It does not just have all the I am statements in there. John is genius, the way he puts that book together. Mm-hmm. And it has the very best ending of any book in the world. I love the last verse, so you have to go back and read it. Sorry.
That's great. Love it.
What is the worst book you have ever read? Were you able to get something out of it anyways?
Oh my gosh. I will say, and maybe I just didn't give it a fair shake, but Conrad's Heart of Darkness, it was really tough, and I don't remember anything that I got out of it. But I had to read it for school, and it was like in eighth grade, so that might have contributed a little bit.
So that's really funny. If you had asked me 2 years ago, I would have said Huck Finn. Because
really?
Did you have
to read it in eighth grade?
No, it was I think it was like 11th grade, American Lit.
Yeah.
Okay. I have no memory. I got an A in that class. I don't know how, because I have no memory of reading that book at all. I read the Cliff Notes. Don't recall in any way reading the book. So I would have said that. And then just this year, I had to read Huck Finn as part of this project. And I thought, oh, Lord, it's going to be a bad week.
And it was so good.
I loved it. You have to give it another chance.
Yeah, maybe so.
Loved it. But I also read other bad books. So.
This is for Cheryl. Were you surprised by any of the books you read in the last year from the classics list?
On a daily basis. I mean, okay.
So what were the most surprising?
Okay, so the first week you read Plato's Last Days of Socrates. That was the first week. Oh, I was like, oh my word, this is Plato. This is gonna be bad. Right. Okay, well, nobody tells you. It's written in a dialogue. That's like a play, right? And this is the story of these guys watching their mentor and friend be sentenced to death and then die. Choose death. He chooses death over exile, and then he goes to his death. I didn't expect to cry over the death of a man 2,500 years ago. That, like, really caught me off guard. So that was the first surprise. There were a lot of others, but I don't want to blame.
Why were you surprised by Boethius?
Oh, Boethius. Well, first of all, The Consolation of Philosophy. What a title. I thought this would be terrible. And I mean, I just thought it would be super boring. I thought it was... Okay, so what Boethius is, he's a man sentenced to die. It's at the tail end of the Roman Empire. He's sentenced to die, and he feels like... He's really kind of under house arrest. He's in his office, his library, surrounded by his books. And he... Anyway, Lady Wisdom, Lady Philosophia, Lady Wisdom shows up, and he's like, why aren't you enough? Why aren't you enough? And so they go through this whole long talk about life. And it's really
beautiful. Yeah.
And what happens at the end, though, is really interesting, is that he realizes that wisdom, human knowledge, isn't enough, that what he really needed was faith.
Yep.
And so... Like, it sounds boring, except it's a dialogue, and he's having this conversation, and then it's kind of goofy the way this book is put together, because there's these little poems at the end of every chapter, and I kind of got to start thinking of him as, like, dance breaks, and he would, like, give you a little poem about what he just talked about, and it sounds like it's boring, but it's actually, like, really moving.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah. Boethius, you should read it. Everybody. What's funny is that it wasn't just C.S. Lewis's favorite book. Until, like... The 1800s, every smart person loved this book. So if you've read a person who's written a book in the 1800s, their favorite book was probably Boethius,
mm-hmm.
which you would never know.
And now no one's ever even heard of them. Yep.
Which books do you think high schoolers should be required to read?
Such an excellent question and such a long list. So I am a big fan of reading the classics, obviously. So I think that reading Plato, Socrates, Aristotle, that's a great thing to do. But I also think that reading things like To Kill a Mockingbird, really good. I think reading Shakespeare in high school is really important. I think Charles Dickens is really important in high school as well. I think that part of what is sad is that the traditional canon of things that people used to read has pretty much gone out the window in favor of trying to bring in other voices that people thought were excluded. And some of those are really good to read, but if you haven't read the other stuff first, you don't have any framework. So I think that starting with those kinds of books would be really important. What would you say to that?
So Winston Churchill said that it's a pity if you come to a book too early. And so
that's
I
true.
Think that you have to be cautious about high school and books, because there's many books that have ideas in them that you're not ready for in high school. Or if you don't have a good guide, an enthusiastic teacher for them, that they're going to be harder for
you. Yes, I'm just going to have a little momentary rant right here. One of the things that is really wrong right now, and part of the reason so many people don't read, is that we are so oriented, particularly in high school, to teaching to the test, and teaching to the AP exam, and annotating. And there is nothing that will kill your love for reading like annotating. And it is, it should be banned. Whoever thought of that should be put in prison. It's just so terrible because it takes something that is beautiful and makes it seem like slavery.
Yeah.
And I
don't know that it's the book is that important. I think that what happens in school is that you're supposed to read a book not so that it can change your heart. And the problem is that most of these books, if you're allowed to read them the right way, they're going to change your heart.
Yep.
And not being allowed that space, just having to learn the plot and learn, like, what was the tone and what were the influences, that stuff is going to wring the heart out of a book. And that's my personal problem with any book. Like, you have to be careful with high schoolers and their books, because you need to allow room for them to change your heart, because they can. Any of them can.
Yep. And the other thing I would say is the last part of my rant.
Okay. Well, I was going to say, one book, though, I think that all high schoolers should read is The Narrative of the Life of an American Slave by Frederick Douglass.
Yeah, that's a great book.
That is a great book, and every American should read it.
Yeah, so I don't remember what my rant
sorry,
was
I didn't
now,
mean to do
but
that.
It's okay. It'll come back to me.
I ranted about, like, changing your heart.
Yes, yes. It's gone, but it'll come back.
Sorry.
All right, we can move on.
Does listening to audiobooks count as reading?
I would say it is better than not. I would almost take listening to an audiobook over Kindle, mm-hmm. If you're not doing something else at the same time. I mean, driving, I think, is fine. But my experience is sometimes people who are listening to an audiobook are trying to do too many things, and so they're not really engaging with what is going on. So, but I think particularly if you have somebody who reads with expression and feeling, the audiobook can be a good supplement to actually doing the physical reading.
Gentleman in Moscow is excellent on audio.
Yeah.
Has society evolved in how we share wisdom, given that stories were mostly passed down orally and books are a recent development? I get more from movies and music.
I think that certainly society has changed in how we pass these things from one generation to another. I think music and movies can be good ways of sharing a story. But I also think that there is something that is profound about the written word, and that nothing else is exactly like it, and that a book will often stay with you in the way that a movie might not. Music may stay with you, but it's not usually conveying a narrative in the way that a book would do. I do think one of the things that is sad is that we are losing the art of storytelling. I'm still old enough to remember that it used to be whenever I would go to my relatives' houses, who were all Southern, after dinner, we would go sit on the porch, and the older people would tell stories, and they would tell stories about relatives, or they would tell stories about something from the past, and it was an amazing, fascinating bonding time that helped you sort of know a little bit about who you were and where you came from. And I think that we have lost that, and that is sad to me. And I think that sort of passing on of stories from generation to generation was important, but there was also a sense of passing on certain books from generation to generation that we also have largely lost.
Okay, so in this project, I had 9 Shakespeare plays in 3 weeks, and I had no experience with Shakespeare. right? Oh, it had been many, many years, read two plays. Hate Julius Caesar still. I might give it another try later. Anyway, I had to find a way in really fast, and that way was movies.
Mm-hmm.
I watched movies first, and that's actually a really great way if you are not sure about, like, can I understand this language? Or
mm-hmm.
I found mm-hmm. for me that the movie, and then I went back and read. I didn't count the movie as like, okay, now I've read it. I used it so that I could have in mind the plot, the general, what was going to happen. And then I went back and struggled with the language. And then it wasn't really so much of a struggle because you kind of know what's happening.
Yeah.
And it gets easier. And so I think movies are a really important part of getting stories, or they can be. And so I don't mm-hmm. think that we discount them completely. But I think that my experience was getting this, watching the movie, but then going back and reading Hamlet.
Right. Yeah. Because I think I completely agree with you.
That,
and I think that can whet your appetite.
Yeah.
For it, and because it gives you the broad contours of what's going
right.
on, then you can go in and you can appreciate. Like, I think it's great to watch the Lord of the Rings movies and then go read the books,
yeah.
Because it will make you appreciate the books all the more after you've done that.
Right.
In terms of reading helping retention, are there certain genres like fiction or history, for example, that you have found to be more helpful over others?
I will tell you what the studies say, and my own experience bears that out, that the things that you retain the most are good fiction. So if you're reading good fiction that does a really good job of describing sort of what the world is like, the more that you enter into a beautifully made world, whether it's a description of the past or the present or some other country that is new to you, the more vivid the fiction is, the more your brain engages with that. And it literally puts you into that place where you're experiencing the heat of the summer in India when there's no air conditioning during the Raj or, you know, whatever it might be. You are really living into that. And that imprints on your brain in a way that reading just a factual narrative of history will not. On the other hand, if you have a historian who's a good storyteller, that can make all the difference.
That's the best way to read history. Like, so there's a guy who wrote a history of the Caesars, the first 12 Caesars, and he wrote it in 125. The guy was a massive gossip. He knew half of the people. And so when you're reading this, he's like giving you like the inside scoop. And this is from 125 AD, right? But he makes all of these people real. So if you have a good historian, he's going to make it real.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to be like, oh, yeah, I wouldn't want to get near, you know, Octavian when he was acting like that. That would have been bad or whatever. Because Suetonius was there. And he knew somebody who knew someone who was, you know, working for the guy. And he knew, he saw these things firsthand.
Yep.
And so those kinds of histories, it's actually so much fun. And that was a huge surprise for me in this reading project because I'd never read anything like that before.
All right, maybe one more.
Do you think a cheesy beach read romance has the same kind of positive impact?
No.
But they have their
Thanks
place.
For coming.
They have their place.
It can. It can have an impact. It depends on how bad it is. I think that there are levels of cheesiness. I think that books that are essentially just giving you enough plot to get from one bedroom scene to another, those are not helpful. But books, even if they're cheesy, if they've got longing in them and they've got some beauty and some joy in them, they're certainly better than just scrolling Instagram.
Oh, I mean, but well, okay, so I love reading a spy novel on vacation.
Oh, I do too.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, you know, I think that there's plenty of places for stuff like that. I think that one thing that I've become like sensitized to with modern fiction a lot is like, y'all, quit reading about the person who works in advertising in New York City or in the city, the person who's working in publishing. You know, there's like this very, have you noticed like in a lot of
it's
modern
niche,
current
yeah.
fiction, like that the people in there are really like narrow. Like, there's only, they all have, five different occupations, and they all, operate in the same little circle, and it's very boring. So find people that are interesting to read about. Even if it's, a cheesy novel, have somebody be a scientist or not a writer, not an advertiser, not a publisher. How about that?
Yeah.
Something like that. You know what I mean?
And I will say that, the genre that I think is really cheesy are the beach sex novels. those are just... But detective stories, spy novels, and one of the ones I used to feel so guilty about liking this, but there's a series of novels by P.G. Wodehouse that are the Jeeves and Wooster stories, and they are hilarious, but they're pretty lightweight, shall we say.
You know, you're going to feel like a nerd when you read them, but they are absolutely hilarious.
Yes, they are so hilarious.
They are so funny.
But I felt so bad about, why do I like this so much? I should like something more serious. But the fact of the matter is that I felt vindicated one day when I was reading through C.S. Lewis's collected letters, and there is a page in this book, and I saw P.G. Wodehouse, so I was like, what? And then Lewis writes, I think P.G. Wodehouse is the most brilliant writer of comedy in the English language, and his section in this particular book about when Gussie Finknottle is giving out the prizes at the school is the funniest passage in the English language. And I was like, yes, this is great. So on that note, thank you all so much for coming. I hope you will read more and come back and join us again in 2 weeks. And thanks for Cheryl for coming.
Thank you. This was fun.